Hello everyone, my name is Rudo Manjoro. Thank you for tuning in to Geopol Talks. Today we will be speaking about the impact of COVID-19. We will be discussing the vaccine, the economical impact, and the societal. Stay tuned.
Joined by a lovely panel, and we are going to be speaking about COVID-19 and the effects of COVID-19. I just would like everybody to introduce themselves. Fran, we can start with you.
Hello, my name is Fran Bodine. I'm based in Denver, Colorado in the US. And I was recently hired at Geopol as the Marketing Insights Manager, where I helped to create and analyze the marketing-led surveys like the one we'll be talking about today.
Great. Thank you, Fran. Thank you for joining us on this podcast today. Matt?
Thanks, Rita. Hi, my name is Matt Angus Hammond. I am the Regional Director for West Africa at Geopol. I'm responsible for the West Africa markets, but COVID circumstances have left me stranded in Johannesburg, where I'm based at the moment.
That's great. We're happy to have you back home. Amanda.
Hi, everyone. I'm Amanda Nyanongo, and I am the Client Services Account Manager for the Southern African region. I recently joined Geopol in Feb of this year.
Welcome to the team. It's been lovely having you. And Franklin.
Hi, everyone. My name is Franklin Kebwacha. I am the Digital Marketing Manager at Geopol, and I'm based in Nairobi, Kenya.
Welcome, Franklin. All right, so that is our lovely panel. So today we are going to be speaking about the economical impact, the societal impact, and the perception and concerns about the vaccine. But before we go into this conversation, I would like our marketing insights manager, Fran, to kind of give us a background about how this research came about and which regions were, you know, where the research took place.
Thanks, Rudo. We conducted this study as a follow-up to the studies we conducted in 2020 on the impact of COVID-19 in sub-Saharan Africa. We, with the pandemic dragging now into its second year, we conducted this survey to assess the ongoing effects on respondents' finances, spending and health, their thoughts and concerns about the vaccine, and their hopes for the future. The study was implemented using our own mobile research platform and respondent database via two-way SMS in March and April 2021. And we ran the study in six countries: Cote d'Ivoire, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya, Mozambique, Nigeria, and South Africa. With a total sample size of 400 per country and 2,400 total, we used a simple random sampling technique from our respondent database of mobile subscribers in each country. And the sample was roughly nationally representative by age, gender, and location.
That is great. All right. So it's good to hear that we have perceptions coming from all over Africa. I think with the report, we will be able to see if majority of the African countries are aligned. Are they all feeling the same way about COVID-19? And especially the changes, are they experiencing the same changes? And are they working towards just getting used to the new normal? Thank you so much, Fran, for that breakdown of the research. So for all the new listeners, please, 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 you can access our report on our website and our different social media platforms. We have Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter. So do access the report there. But yeah, let's jump into the conversation. We are going to be first speaking about the economic impact of COVID-19. I think it's safe to say that we have heard on the news globally in general how it has affected us. I mean, mainly economically. There has been a lot of employment changes, salary increases and decreases. We've seen a lot of businesses close down, especially businesses that need physical interaction. So South Africa saw actually a huge change in employment, and a lot of people were retrenched, and there was a huge change in our economy. I think it's safe to say that here there has been poverty increases, crime increases. Just looking at our research, it does state that we actually hit a record high employment rate in South Africa close to October and December of 2020. Can you share just how it's changed, COVID-19 has changed your life in economically? How has your economic lifestyle just changed?
Thanks, Rita. Well, very fortunately, I work for a company that sort of specializes in non-face-to-face methods of collecting research data. So we've been kept busy, very busy, in fact, throughout this pandemic. But in terms of, it becomes increasingly apparent that, some of us with any crisis, some people come out okay, and they, for one reason or another, they've managed to shield themselves from the worst of it. But they're always surrounded by people who haven't, and people have had salary cuts. As you say, people have lost their jobs. Businesses have shut down. I think, particularly in South Africa here, the impact on the sort of the leisure sector, tourism, and sport, and restaurants, the entertainment sector, is almost completely ground to a halt last year. And I think, however, certainly in the last 6 months or so, things have got better almost by virtue of the fact that they couldn't get any worse. I'm sure everyone else sort of had the same sort of, and it was that came through a lot in the data as well, not just from South Africa, but from all over the place, I think.
Absolutely. That is true. And I mean, I know you are a father. I also know that Franklin is also a parent. Has there been any difficulty when coming to your children, and also considering your children, just in the economical sense?
Yeah, it's very well documented, I think, globally. My daughter's 3, my son is 8 months. And my daughter in particular really has, a year or so without much social interaction is a third of her life. And it has an impact on children all over the world. We know about this. And it's going to be, it takes a lot of, and you have to make a lot of different difficult calls. Is it safe out there from a COVID perspective? But also, my kids need the social development. They need the interaction. They need to be stimulated. They need education. And all these things, I'm sure. All parents around the world are in the same boat. Franklin, I'm sure you're in the same situation.
For me, I have felt it. So my daughter just turned 4. She should have joined school in January this year, but she didn't because of the whole situation with schools being closed. And, there are some tendencies of, do I really want to take her to school at this point, or do I want to homeschool her? And if I homeschool her, what is going to happen to her social life? She needs that interaction with other children. And so we had to push our start school to later this year. And there's also the aspect of working from home and having to learn to work with my toddler jumping and playing around. And sometimes she comes up to me in the middle of work and tells me to play and seek with her. And again, I do. But she has learned that I'm at work. So I think it's a readjustment even for the kids, because she has learned that I'm working, especially when I have meetings. And she's starting to know how to make compromises. It's fun working from home, but then there's that aspect of her not joining school and she should have joined school, and interacting with other kids when she needs it most.
I resonate to that, because even when somebody is in my space, maybe my niece or my nephew, it's always just the balance of saying, okay, I'm at work now, and then later on we can bond and talk and at least have this one-on-one interaction. So I do, I do absolutely connect to that. Yes, Amanda.
I think when you said we saw a record numbers in terms of the employment, my heart just sank a little bit because in South Africa, we already have a huge unemployment problem, especially youth unemployment. So what COVID did was basically accelerated what is already a slippery slope. And, you know, having friends who were retrenched and people close to me and having a parent who's a small business owner, you know, I also saw the economic effects of the pandemic, you know, up close and personal. And it was so tough because you're aware that we do need a hard lockdown just to mitigate the cases and try to keep things under control as much as possible. But at the same time, you're also concerned about your economic livelihood and your livelihood in general, and being able to put, you know, food on the table, caring for others, people that are depending on you financially. And I think after the hard lockdown, after a while, it sort of felt like, you know, we have to do a trade-off between, you know, choosing livelihoods from an economic perspective or choosing the health of people. So it felt that between a rock and a hard place definitely was emphasized a lot of times very early on when the pandemic first came to SA. I thought that.
That is very true. And I mean, as a youth South African woman, do you feel like you have to not only work harder, but you need to find side hustles or side jobs that in order for you to be financially in a good place? Do you find yourself thinking about having another stream of income? Because in South Africa, I mean, it is really bad and the unemployment rates have just, it's actually shocking.
Absolutely. I think being a young Black immigrant, I'm already like belonging to two marginalized groups who definitely have not always had fair chances. So in terms of thinking about additional income, definitely that did come to my mind, but also trying to balance where do I rest in between, because that's also very key. And I think, you know, the capitalist system we're in is very, very big on hard work, but it's almost as if resting is taboo. So what for me was an idea was, okay, maybe I should start a side hustle. But what was also a concern of mine is maybe I should also rest and protect my mental health. So it was definitely sort of always feeling like choosing between a lot of things in the pandemic. That's how I've always just constantly felt and still do feel like, okay, I want to, you know, go out there and pursue something else outside of my 9 to 5 to get additional income. But at the same time, I'm also tired. I'm also weary. I'm tired of being indoors. I just need to preserve my mental health. What do I choose? Yeah.
Yeah, I think definitely. Yes, please.
Sorry, Rita. Just some perspective from Nigeria here, where as the listeners, most of the listeners will know, you know, Nigeria's had a lot of chaos in the economy in particular, but in politics and for decades now, really sort of since independence, everything's been a big roller coaster there. And it's a place where, you know, when you start sort of doing business there and talking to people, you realize that absolutely everyone has a side hustle, usually at least one, more like two or three. You know, a standard salaried income is not enough, is not reliable enough, it's generally not enough in terms of quantity. Yeah, it's all sorts of things. There's e-commerce. I know one of our people there runs a secondhand baby clothes shop online as well, and you know, things like that. It's a very dynamic, very entrepreneurial sort of culture. But it's also the case, certainly I found across most of West Africa, and I think South Africa to a certain extent is the exception. But it's changing rapidly. We're learning to innovate more and be more entrepreneurial. But we've got a long way to go until we get to where Nigeria is. And COVID's just really exaggerated that. People's side hustles, and this is, again, something that's happening all over the place. People's side hustles are now becoming main hustles because the main job, either they lost it or it's been scaled back. And a lot of people are not necessarily going to go back to their original job because their original job might not be available anymore. And so the side hustle becomes their main focus. And they'll have to find then another side hustle for their side hustle.
One interesting finding from the study that kind of relates to all of this and ties all this together, despite the high unemployment rates, 31% of the people in this study said that they're the employed people in this study said that they're considering taking a step back in their careers due to the virus, the pandemic. So
that's interesting.
Are trying to balance their responsibilities at home and their work life, trying to find some happy compromise there.
Sorry to just circle us back. I just have a question for Matt. With your exposure to West Africa and South Africa, why do you think there's a discrepancy in the multiple sources of income attitude in the different regions? Why do you think West Africa is more driven towards having multiple sources of income, but it's only something that's slowly becoming a thing in SA? Why do you think that discrepancy is?
That's probably a whole other podcast. There's a lot of in a few second nutshell. I think it's got a lot to do with how the sort of the economic and history of both countries. South Africa is and always has been a country or economy very much structured around specific large corporations. Who have largely owned and run the South African economy for almost centuries and still do. Whereas, Nigeria, there was a lot of that sort of structure and those sort of large corporations in place, but they all, virtually all of them disintegrated, went broke, left the country, whatever the case may be. The economy was sort of broken down to its most basic building blocks, which is, of course, one person running a business. And so I think we've got, to a certain extent, and the South African government, depending on who you were, didn't necessarily look after you very well. But there was always a sense of sort of telling you what to do and looking after you. In Nigeria, there was no care at all, basically no government in a lot of respects. So they've learned to fend for themselves.
All right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think all of us can resonate to just wanting to do more so that we are not financially pressured. I mean, based on our report, we can see that the World Bank has stated that 6.1% there has been a 6.1% decline in income in sub-Saharan Africa last year alone. So you can just imagine just COVID leading into 2021, how terrible the retrenchments and the income decreases must have been. And I feel like we work for a great company. So I'm just thinking about other people outside in just our regions must feel financially pressured. So I know for myself, I have changed a lot of habits. Like I don't leave all the lights on. I take shorter showers. I cook earlier in the day than later just so that my electricity bill isn't as high. Are there any habits that you have changed in order to save more to save more so that you don't feel as financially pressured? Franklin, can you give us your way of handling the situation?
Yeah. Thankfully, as you said, my income has not been directly affected much with the pandemic, but there has been indirect impacts. Things are more expensive. Family members and close friends have been affected, and I have to show them more financial responsibility. So we cannot run from the fact that everyone has been affected economically in some way. And Kenya had the highest number of people in that survey who said their incomes have dropped. A whole 79%, which I can attest to because a big part of my circle, friends, family have lost jobs or have their businesses struggling, and that goes back to, in part, the lockdown the government had to impose with the third wave or fourth. I might have lost count of the waves. But one thing that I've observed a lot of people doing, and this has also come to me, is priorities are adjusting. A lot of people are using their savings and whatever resources they had in real estate, for example, because Kenyans have strong feelings about owning homes, and I'm seeing more and more people build and buy homes from, you know, whatever resources they had, due to the realization that when income said unexpectedly, like they have been happening recently, rent becomes, you know, the top concern, for example. And at the beginning, we had a lot of panic buying for food and essentials. I'm guilty of that too. That has normalized when we learned that the world is not ending. But you know, for a lot of people, it's, you know, also because they don't have that money, much money to spend. And for me, I would say, personally, I've reduced spending on a lot of things, just like you said, Rudo, and it's mostly because of the lifestyle change. For example, I don't go to malls a lot now, so I don't buy, you know, toys for my daughter impulsively, because, you know, we won't go to the malls. There's less travel, so almost no spend on trips and the like. So yeah, lifestyle has changed, and with it, spending habits have changed, even for me and for a lot of people.
Absolutely. And it's evident in our research, as it states that more people have stopped spending more on food and necessities because they have less money. I mean, 76% of the respondents of the research just stated that it's due to less money. But Fran, just to ask you, are there any other reasons why you feel that you might be spending more money or less money, apart from the fact of financial changes?
One thing that when we did talk in the study about spending on food and necessities, it seemed like most people came in on the extremes. Either people were spending, their spending on food necessities had gone down, decreased a lot. And like you said, that was mainly due to the fact that they had less money to spend. But then a significant number of people also said that their spending has increased. And most of those people attributed that to inflation. And particularly in Nigeria, where they've had record inflation rates and record food inflation rates. And then there's also spending across the board, pretty much. There's been spending decreases on non-essential items, which is very understandable. If food has to be the priority, so the spending is going to go there first. So of course, the non-essential items, spending is going to decrease there across the board.
Yeah, so in Nigeria, certainly, in particular, the supply chain in the sort of retail space has always been a bit tenuous. It's the infrastructure is really bad. It's difficult to get things around, but there's huge demand from this massive population. So when something like this then shocks through the system, we've had a lot of people on the ground. They report empty shelves and things just not getting to where they need to be. And obviously, you know, factories shutting down production and that sort of a negative feedback cycle that happens. So it's certainly something we're seeing in front of us, as well as in the numbers in Nigeria.
Sure. That is absolutely hectic. And for some weird reason, and I'm happy that the research backs this, is that food has increased, prices have increased, even though they know that their citizens, you know, that a lot of people have their salary has been cut. What are your thoughts on this? Do you feel that businesses have increased their prices to keep afloat, to pay their employees? I mean, what are your thoughts on this? It's very contradictory, because now you're thinking, okay, food is expensive. Not a lot of people will not be able to buy food, but you know for a fact that now businesses have to try and keep afloat and make a business and be able to pay the employees. What are your thoughts on this situation?
I think it's a catch 22. So I live alone. I don't have a cat. I don't have a dog. I don't have a goldfish. Like, it's just me. But the amount of money I spend on groceries, even when really just buying the necessities and non-luxurious items, it's insane. And that amount, no matter how much I budget, no matter how much I look out for great deals, keeps increasing and increasing. Whilst I know that businesses do have to sort of increase their costs in order for them to keep afloat, I think that we must also just take into context that we are in a pandemic and try to keep those prices as reasonable as possible, because the cost of living is increasing, but not the income of people is increasing. So it's just becoming more expensive, but I don't have more money to buy. I just have, you know, the same amount of money versus increasing costs. And most recently, there was communication that tariffs are possibly being increased, and it's already winter. And it feels like everything is just increasing till no limit. So I also think we must have, you know, the government step in some sort of way to provide, you know, economic relief for citizens and meet us halfway as well.
Absolutely. Any other perceptions on this? You know, how is it in Nigeria or Kenya perspective? Are you aligned with us in South Africa?
It is true that prices of, you know, essentials have gone up. But for me, and if you ask a lot of Kenyans, we will ultimately point fingers at, you know, the government and government policies. At this point, we feel like the government should be cautioning people, especially the people at the lower end of the economic spectrum, because, I mean, lacking necessities such as food should not be something that is such a huge issue in this century. But then, case in point, Kenya, fuel is at the highest it has ever been ever. And you know, when fuel is high, when fuel is high, prices go up. And looking further, we realize that it's not because fuel prices have gone high, globally, but it's because we have to, the government has to increase tax for certain things, including fuel, so that we are able to, you know, attend to decisions that have been made, especially regarding loans and the like, which, you know, much of Africa is grappling with. So I guess I'm speaking for a lot of Kenyans, like, we feel like the government is not taking care of, you know, of us, you know, of us people, and the policies are not favoring the situation.
Yeah, and it shows, because when we asked our respondents, do they feel optimistic about their financial situation? Majority of them, I think, if you're looking at the report, 37% of them said not at all. They're not at all optimistic. They don't think there will be any improvement in the next 3 months. So, you know, I think it's just a matter of trying yourself and your family, you know, trying to change the financial situation for the better, even if you're in a good space, to be able to be in an even better space, taking advantage of the digital area, being a digital entrepreneur, you know, just these different ways of trying to be in a better financial position is needed, and it needs to be practiced, especially now with all the financial changes that we do see. But I want to step into the perceptions and concerns about the COVID-19 vaccine. I don't know if you guys have heard of a lot of false information, but on my side, I have heard so many myths, so many negative perceptions, and The other day, I was actually looking at a video broadcasted by BBC of a group, well, many different people around the world stating that the vaccine is actually magnetic. It makes your body magnetic. And there were viral videos going around about people sticking cards, coins, anything that had anything that was magnetic, they would stick to their body. And it was actually fake news. They found the people who were on the videos, and they were just saying it was just a joke. But it actually left such a negative and even worse perception on a lot of people globally. So just to hear around the table, have you heard of anything negative on the vaccine? And do you doubt the vaccine? Do you feel like it's not safe?
I am a huge conspiracy theorist fan. Look, I believe in all of it. Shape-shifting, reptilian British royals. I draw my line at being a flat earther. But, you know, it's very unfortunate that, you know, people would think the pandemic is a hoax and the vaccine is a hoax, especially in SA, where we haven't really had the fastest rollout of the vaccine. And, you know, it is getting into phase two, but that is our elderly people who a lot of them are being influenced by that propaganda of the vaccine, you know, being fake, or it being, I don't know what else people say, like having radio effects. And it also doesn't help the matter when we have, you know, public figures. Our Chief Justice not so long ago made some interesting remarks surrounding their vaccine and, you know, expressing that, you know, it might be some form of evil. And I think we just need to find a way of informing people the right way about the vaccine, what it does. And the vaccine is not, you know, something that can make you immortal. People still get shocked that they're still getting the virus. Even after getting the vaccine, it doesn't mean, you know, it makes you foolproof from the virus. But I think a lot of misinformation is happening, and a lot of correction, it needs to be done.
Absolutely. And I just want to get some perspective, the American perspective. I just want to, okay, let's start that. I just want to understand the American perspective. How is your rollout plan that side?
There's still a lot of conspiracy theories going around. A big one has been that Bill Gates is using it to install microchips in everybody. That's a big one. Unfortunately, in the U.S. too, it has also turned into a political issue with certain parts of certain political parties refusing to do it just on, I guess, political principle. But even through that, I guess, on a positive note, I think it was just a couple days ago, 50% of the adult population in the U.S. Is fully vaccinated now. So it is in the last few months, I feel like it's turned a corner a little bit and is finally moving in the right direction.
All right. Well, that's good to hear. And Matt, would you get vaccinated, and do you have any concerns?
Of course, I would, no concerns at all. I think in the West African context, I think, and probably more broadly as well, overcoming the hesitancy issue is something that's going to require a lot of different sectors of society to work together. I think in particular, faith leaders, primarily across Africa, it's Christian and Muslim leaders, and they have a huge amount of influence. And one of the big problems we've seen in Nigeria, and what has a potential still to be a huge problem, if we look at what happened in India, is mass gatherings for worship. There was a bit of a break in the beginning, but your typical Nigerian Pentecostal church is now we're now talking with thousands of people packed into a warehouse, side by side, no masks. We've had some interesting, slightly different accounts from the Muslim parts of Nigeria, where I think it's in the nature of Islamic worship that it's slightly more straightforward to socially distance, and you see people praying, you know, 2 meters away from each other, and keeping the face masks or you know on their way in and out, at least, even if they're not doing it while they're actually praying.
Yeah,
I think that side of things, when it comes to things which aren't, you know, science doesn't have answers for things that are made up, if you know what I mean. So it's very difficult. You can't prove that Bill Gates hasn't put a microchip in you, because where do you even start? So you need to go through the roots of what people believe rather than what you can prove. And that's why I think it starts with people's faith. Certainly in Africa.
Especially, thank you, especially in Africa, because we have so many factors that impact what we believe. Amanda, were you tuning in there?
No, I'm like, you know, nodding my head till it almost falls off, because we are, you know, a very religious continent. And, you know, you don't have to necessarily agree with it or disagree with it, but, you know, it does become a huge issue when it's joined with misinformation, public figures, public religious figures, you know, perpetuating false narratives. It becomes, you know, quite a huge issue. But I think in South Africa, for me, I was very proud and taken aback by, you know, the ZCC Church, which is one of the biggest churches in South Africa, being so compliant with the laws. You know, they have their yearly annual gathering during Easter called Moria, and, you know, they haven't had that, and they really have been, you know, setting such a great example to say, look, we are still worshiping, just not in the conventional way, and we don't need to gather and have super spreader events. And I was really proud.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, Mozambique and Kenya have different perceptions, and I think Franklin can speak on this. They feel that actually they haven't been educated enough. They haven't been told about the vaccine. They feel that COVID-19, they still have a lot of questions. Franklin, can you just speak on the media perspective? I mean, being in Kenya, do you think that the media has educated the public, the different platforms that they're using? Is it effective?
From personal experience, so my mom got the vaccine, but she had to call me and ask me questions on whether I think she should take it. And it got me thinking, does that mean she didn't trust the government and the media when they talked about the vaccine? Mm. Or is it because they did not do enough to educate her about the vaccine? And is the misinformation stronger than the credible information? It's quite a thin line between, you know, what is being peddled as the right information and what the right information is. Because I personally feel like, you know, stakeholders in the media, in health and in government should be doing more in reaching more people and giving them credible information. And in the survey, only 42% said they feel they had received credible information on the vaccine. So I do feel like there's a lot that remains to be done in terms of educating the masses.
All right. Well, in South Africa, I do have to say that I believe that the media has done their part. We have so many different platforms where they educate us on a daily, to the point where they've actually they actually contact us through our network providers. There was a time early in COVID at the peak where the network providers actually changed on your phone. You would see take care MTN or stay safe Telkom, to the point where we even have WhatsApp emergency, a WhatsApp emergency account. Medical aides would always contact us and giving us notifications that, okay, in your area, it's known as a hotspot right now, so please keep very safe. So I do think in South Africa and the media in general has really, really communicated to the best of their ability. We also have national broadcasts where our president Cyril Ramaphosa will come on and he'll tell us the statistics, and he'll tell us the different level of restrictions that we have. So I do think South Africa has actually done their part. It's more the youth in their belief system and just believing what they believe and just having, I guess I would say, the FOMO of now going out and enjoying their youthful lives.
Rudo, yes, I would mind if I ask a follow-up question to you then. In that when we conducted this study with the same six countries in November, in South Africa, 69% of the population said that they would likely get the vaccine as soon as it was available for free. But now when we took that in April now, that number dropped from 69% down to 48%. And I'm wondering, yep, if the information is there, I'm wondering what might have caused that decline just in the last 21% decline just in the last 3 months.
So South Africa is very, very driven. Well, the youth, I want to say, is very driven by actually not even the youth, just our citizens, religion and politics. So when you see the leaders of maybe a religious group or a political group doubting the vaccine, you would see majority of us also following that path. We will also say, actually, if the president doesn't take it and the leaders don't take it first, then I'm not going to take it, because they actually have the communication with America or the other countries that have already rolled out the vaccine. So it's just it's just that thing of, if you do it, then I will do it. But we haven't really had a grand example of our leaders taking the vaccine. And I think therefore we are kind of shying away from taking the vaccine. And also just the many myths that we see religiously. It's saying, oh no, this is evil, or oh no, you're going to get sick because this is not godly, you know. So a lot of just comments and beliefs. They don't even have to believe it, but they will shy away from just being the first one in the family per se to take the vaccine. They just don't. They're scared of the unknown. And that's why we see majority of the youth just kind of saying, okay, not me first. Let's see what happens when the elders take it, or mainly the leaders take it. I don't know if Amanda has the same view.
Thanks, Rudo. I would have a slightly different view. I would maybe say that decrease could be attributed to a decrease in the level of trust in the government. Our vaccine administration has not been the greatest. We have had, you know, issues with the vaccine, talks of, you know, it not being stored properly, therefore not being able to, you know, be efficient. We've had certain social media posts where before the vaccine even arrived officially, people were like, oh, look, here's a picture. I managed to get the vaccine. And there's a lot of, you know, corruption within our government. And I think that's a very, what can I say, open secret to say. Yeah. And I was on my medical aid web page, and they sent me a link, and there's a little scale that showed how long it would take to get this percentage of the population vaccinated with both doses. And the result was basically, there's a higher chance of me dying than, you know, getting at least over 50% of the population vaccinated. So I think the administration of the vaccine, the rollout, has been quite poor. And then that reluctance to then take it, you know, arises. So it's not, I don't think it's necessarily people, you know, not wanting to take it, but believing that they won't get it anytime soon.
Absolutely. And just to add, I think it's also just adding on to Amanda's comment, is we also heard that the vaccine expires. So a lot of people are saying, okay, if it expires, then why am I going to take it if the government is still allowing people from certain countries to enter South Africa, especially if the government is lowering the restrictions, but they know the vaccine is going to expire, then why am I taking it? And why do we then have to wait for something that might not even be, you know, that might not even make much of a difference? So, yeah, that's just, I think that's just where the South African youth is at. Sorry, Matt, please do continue.
No, it's interesting to hear. I'm too old to know what the youth is saying. I think you made a very good point in general, though, is that, and it's the same in America, it's the same everywhere, is that this pandemic has become completely tangled up with local and global politics. And, yeah. You know, in South Africa, for example, we put our ex-president on trial today I think he has his first day in court today, or that was the plan. I can't remember if it, I lost track if it actually happened.
Yeah.
In Ivory Coast, in late last year, there were protests, people were being locked up, and the election of the president was highly divisive. There's a lot of hangovers from the civil war that aren't sorted out yet. Nigeria had massive protests, and then there was that incident of the Lekki toll gate, where all those protesters got shot. It was a very, very difficult, volatile time. The pandemic has brought people's grievances out. It's made people's lives worse. And so if their lives are already bad to start off with, they've got less to lose and they're fighting back. But it also feeds into a very, you know, we're operating in places where there's generally a very low perception or trust in the government anyway. You know, we South Africans don't have much faith in their government. I can tell you Nigerians have less. We didn't cover Ghana in this, but Ghana probably has the least, interestingly enough, because it's considered well governed, but Ghanaians have the lowest opinion of their government of anyone I've met. So all of that context needs to be taken into account when we're trying to understand the attitude to vaccination. I think there's also a big aspect is just, and in many ways, we're India a few months ago. We didn't get it too bad the first wave, and the second wave wasn't too bad either. We've become complacent, and sometimes our belief systems or our religious leaders have led us astray. We are considering things like holding elections, like we are in South Africa. We're due them, and we haven't actually postponed them yet, I believe. Those are all things that happened in India before India wound up where they are now, and that's something worth, I think, noting. I think there's a level of complacency, which is going to make the third wave very difficult across the continent.
Yes, and you know, I mean, I hear all of us are speaking on the government and how much we don't trust the government, but I also think it's also important to speak about how some of our citizens are also being a little bit reckless. Just some people not following the restrictions, not people who don't believe in COVID, just randomly walking on the streets without wearing a mask. I mean, the other day I heard that in India, a couple hosted their wedding on an airplane because they wanted everybody on their list to be present at their wedding. To the point where they dodged the COVID restrictions because they knew that on an airplane people are able to just sit there and travel. So they actually held their wedding in the air just to dodge the COVID restrictions. So I think it's also important to be very honest that to a certain extent the government we can't trust them completely. They haven't really earned as much from our citizens. However, we definitely still have a lot of working to do on ourselves and taking it very seriously so that the third wave can just decrease. I don't know if it's like that in America and in Kenya, where our citizens are not doing their level best.
I think, well, I'm not in any of those countries. I'm in the same country as you, but I think it's twofold. I have to agree with what Matt said that, you know, the pandemic has highlighted a lot of inequalities. So yes, there are citizens who are not adhering to the rules, who are not helping the pandemic, and they are going against the rules and being reckless and, you know, having super spreader events. However, the default economic or socioeconomic living status of a lot of our population does not allow for us to adhere to the rules. A lot of our population are in townships, are in shacks that are very much overcrowded, very much under-resourced. Some don't have access to water. So you can't really social distance when your default conditions are basically crowded. So it's definitely a twofold sort of way of looking at it, where there is a lack of responsibility, but there's also a lot of inequalities being highlighted.
That is very, very true. That is very, very true. So back home, where my grandmother raised me, it is a township, and we have people even in the backyard living, and you're absolutely right. We also have like tuck shops, puzzle shops. Definitely that living condition is your default living condition. I was mainly speaking about citizens who have the education and who choose to go against the rules, who choose to go against the restrictions. Those are the citizens who actually increase the concerns about the vaccine and COVID in general, you know. Yes, Franklin, please.
Sorry. And I just wanted to chime in and put in the Kenyan experience. So a lot of people wear masks and observe, some of the regulations that can be monitored by the government, because you will get arrested for not wearing a mask in public. But as Matt was saying, complacency has set in. So like if you go to the villages or places where the police will not get you, but the police presence is not high, people are living their lives normally. Like there has been no change in how people go about their business. But then
sorry, Franklin, so you just cut. So you can just pick up from
this again.
Yeah.
So for me, it goes back to what leadership is showing us, or what leadership is showing the people. Because, for example, political gatherings are banned in Kenya, on book, but they are happening. The police come to arrest you, and the policeman doesn't have a mask. So it becomes an argument of, why are you arresting me? You don't have a mask. So that gap goes down, and people start thinking that COVID is because if the people are telling us to follow these restrictions, why are they doing the same things they are telling us not to do? And so that message starts getting watered down. And so that's why people do it for the law, but not because they believe in what they are doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. That is true. That is true. And when we asked the respondents, I know we touched on a lot of the rollout plans. When we actually asked our respondents when they feel or when they expect that the vaccine will be available to the public, majority of them did say the second half of 2021. And we are actually, entering the second half of 2021. I can't believe that it's actually going to be June next week. So we really do hope that the expectations are met. I think the highest country to say that they expect it to be in the second half of 2021 is Nigeria. We have not heard of a set rollout plan in Nigeria yet, but we are hoping that it really is rolled out in the second half of 2021. But let's speak about the societal impact. This is one that has literally shaken up everybody's lives. Just the change of working from home, not being able to see your loved ones, not even being some people being stuck in another country, not being able to come back home. I think the societal impact and just how everything has changed in a matter of months has really shaken all of us up. How has the change been for you, Matt, working from home?
I'm the wrong person to ask. I've been working from home for about 6 years.
Oh, yikes.
Wow.
So you are quite used to it. I mean, Amanda...
It's been an opportunity to fine tune it. And it's become much easier to work from home, certainly, because the whole world started doing it. And so in many ways, yeah, if you look at the sort of the way in which things have been reoriented, the amount of ordering, for example, and things you can have delivered and shopping you can do online. And this is not just in South Africa. This is it's taken off massively in Nigeria. We've actually done three or four different projects with clients in the retail space in Nigeria that have been trying to understand how to take advantage of Sorry, I lost you there.
Yeah, I think there was just a little bit of a glitch. So please continue where you left off from.
Where did I leave off?
I think you were saying that it's
working from home.
Yes.
Yes. Taking advantage lots of people are taking advantage really of the new kind of ways in which e-commerce works and the huge amount of things you can order for delivery now, and that's not just the case in South Africa. That's happening in West Africa and East Africa as well. I know that we've had about three or four different clients that have commissioned projects with us to try and understand home delivery in places like Lagos. All they're seeing is delivery bikes zooming out all over the streets of Lagos delivering things to people's houses, which was completely unheard of 3 or 4 years ago.
Sure. Absolutely. Amanda, did you want to add to that?
So I was not like Matt, who is like a pro basically now in working from home. It was my first time working from home in my working career. And in the beginning, it was very rocky. I did feel like I was living at work. It didn't feel like I was working from home. It felt like, I think there was a lot of, there was no respect of boundaries, or there weren't even boundaries to respect in the first place. What I did enjoy was not commuting anymore. That saved a lot of money. And you also realize how tiring commuting is. And then now I work full time from home, and I have come to enjoy it. And I've also curated my living space to say, okay, this is where I work and this is where I relax and this is my bedroom where electronics aren't allowed. And just creating those boundaries, because, there's so many types of fatigues, but digital fatigue is something that I had been experiencing where I just felt like my eyes were behind a screen all the time. So I've learned to put in place boundaries, but I think now I'd say I'm well adjusted.
All right. That is good. And it's definitely making sure that where you are, your space is, you are able to get into the mental space of, okay, I am at work, these are working hours, and okay, now it's time to kind of shut down everything and go cook or go to the gym or just adapt a different type of hobby so that you disconnect from work. And absolutely, digital fatigue is a real thing. On the report, we touch on increased anxiety, depression, and the effects of self-isolation increasing. And we see that in Kenya, a lot of respondents state that emotionally, they're not in a good place. And 30% say that they have improved, the emotional health has improved since January. So a chunk of people, 70% of people actually say that they're still the same. They still feel neutral, they still feel down, they still feel like they need to go out and go back to what they knew as normal. Franklin, are the restrictions in Kenya, do you think they're at that extent to really affect somebody in an extremely negative way emotionally. And how are you feeling?
Yes, I'll agree with that finding, because, well, when that survey was conducted, we were in a pretty serious lockdown, so a lot of people could not get out of certain places, and the curfew had been shorted. The curfew is still there, so there's that emotional pressure of, I can't go out and do the normal things I used to do. I can't go out to, for example, bars and restaurants. And at the point when that survey was conducted, there was a feeling, I can't go visit my family because there's this huge lockdown that does not allow me to get out of certain places. So yeah, people are about to feel pressure mentally because of, life has been distracted in great ways. Then combine that with the fact that incomes are falling and people are trying to think about how they will feed their families, how their children will go to school, and how they will pay rent, be able to sustain themselves. And a personal story, I don't think you guys know this, but I got COVID last year with the family, and beyond the physical, feeling the symptoms and stuff, the biggest impact for me and my family was mental. Like the emotional state at that point was bad, and I think the society should start paying attention to that part. So even as we preach about COVID and its symptoms and the fact that it's killing and the like, we should also start thinking about the emotional turmoil people get. So when they get infected, and also because of the other impacts, the economic impacts, all these other restrictions. I think we as a society should start paying attention to the emotional state of everyone at this point. And I dare say, even above the physical health impact of COVID.
Yo, that is so, Franklin, first and foremost, I'm very happy that you are well and healthy, and that your family is too. And absolutely, I think when somebody gets infected, the very first thing that we run to is your physical well-being. The emotional and the mental is not really, it's not really focused on, because the main aim is to get you physically healthy. Fran, I don't know if you can share with us just some ways that you try to keep your mental health positive and healthy and good.
I think one of the challenges now is just the duration of the pandemic. It's been well over a year now, and it's far from over. And there's also been a lot of ups and downs. So just when you think things are getting better and we're on the recovery, then there's another wave, and that's just exhausting for a while. And
yeah,
as far as trying to stay healthy, I've been slowly trying to get back to living, doing things from before, and not trying to do things where I don't think about it, try not to let it dominate every aspect of my life, but trying to get outside as much as possible, where a lot of the research is saying that's a safe place to be. And there's a lot of research that suggests the positive impact that being outdoors can have on your mental health. But it's a long battle. So I can fully understand how it can be hard for people to continually have to kind of battle the same things over and over. And it just seems like it keeps repeating itself. The same issues keep popping up over and over. So it's definitely a challenge.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it has been an interesting conversation, and I think our listeners out as well can resonate to a lot of the things that we share here today. There is much, much more information and insights on our report, so don't forget to to go visit our social media pages and our website for more information. But it's been a lovely chat. Thank you to our panel. And remember, if you're new to our podcast, don't forget to subscribe, all right? And we will catch you on our next episode. So to everybody, thank you very, very much for sharing your stories, for being open, and for being here today and being alive and still riding this COVID-19 wave. All right. So for myself, thank you.